The use of force also has some new components. One is reliance on Israel to conduct airstrikes that target supposedly dual-use military-civilian entities, such as rail lines, bridges, and industrial plants. A case can be made that such targeting violates international law on protection of civilians. Moreover, the U.S. has been generous in supplying weapons to Israel that are being used in the Iran war in violation of U.S. law. And, of course, there are Trump's threats to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age and eradicate a whole civilization. Clearly war crimes as defined in the Convention on Genocide. Next, whereas previous presidents have expressed the belief that God is on our side when the U.S. uses force abroad, under Trump that belief has become a fixture, not merely a prayer. Finally, we have Trump's failure to explain why war is necessary, what it will accomplish in the national interest, and how long U.S. involvement will take. Previous presidents have spoken regularly to justify military action abroad, but now the public, the press, and Congress get no consistent or meaningful rationale for putting soldiers in harm's way and causing a global energy crisis. Trump has simply plunged ahead. Thus does his administration find itself engaged in a war that is widely unpopular, unsupported by European allies, and extremely costly for the U.S. and the global economy. Previous presidents were defeated by engaging in unlawful and unpopular wars. Trump may well be impeached and removed from office in addition to suffering defeat. But all his troubles stem from his own recklessness. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 14, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Jill Freitas, and Catherine Carley. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gasco. As I'm recording this in mid-April, we are coming out of one of the warmest and driest winters on record in the Pacific Northwest, and snowpack is at catastrophically low levels. Add in the Trump administration's intentional sabotage and decimation of FEMA, the Forest Service, NOAA, and other relevant federal agencies, and it is hard not to think that we are in for an unprecedented fire season. Aside from the threat of homes and communities burning and smoke potentially blanketing vast swaths of the country for months, we in the conservation and climate communities need to prepare for an all-out propaganda blitz from the timber industry and their allied politicians as they use people's fear to open up public lands for industrial extraction. And wildfire is a fact of nature, and we do have to learn to coexist with it. But far too often, we environmentalists focus only on the science or what's going on in the backcountry, ignoring and downplaying the lived experience and real fears the general public has. If we want to protect our forests from the disaster capitalists, as Naomi Klein calls them, it's not enough to be right. We need to be more strategic about the stories we tell and what we focus on. And that is what today's show is all about. The Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance has just released a new wildfire messaging guide designed to cut through the confusion and misinformation about fire, offering simple and effective messaging to reframe the wildfire narrative in a way that centers forest health and community safety over backcountry logging interventions. Alex Budd is an organizer with the Forest Climate Alliance and one of the main authors of the new guide, and he joined me to talk through it. I'll have links to the guide and more in the show notes of the Coast Range Radio podcast feed, which is free and ad-free on all podcast apps, including Spotify. As always, the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. That's coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Reach out anytime. Let me know what you think. Alex, Bud, welcome back to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here.
I'm so happy to be talking with you about this, although the subject itself is, as I talked about in the introduction, I think people are already feeling a lot of fear and apprehension about what this fire season will hold in store, especially with the Trump administration trying to eviscerate the Forest Service, et cetera, et cetera. So with all that queuing you up, this is a perfect time for you all to be putting this wildfire messaging guide out. What are some of the key themes that you are wanting people to take away and that you've included in this guide?
Yeah. So like I mentioned, fire has always been a part of these Western North American forest ecosystems, including the very intentional and skillful use of cultural burning by indigenous communities for thousands of years in maintaining a really healthy and vibrant ecological balance. That balance has been broken and destabilized over the last 100 years, 150 years, as a result of the suppression of all fire in the forest, industrial clear-cut monoculture, logging, climate change, certainly, increasingly, and then also unchecked human development out further into the forests and into these ecosystems. And all of those kind of four things are the kind of main pillars that have destabilized and disrupted this balance. And now we are at a point where, you know, we've all seen pictures and videos seemingly every summer of communities and homes burning down. And like you said, the fear that people feel about having their entire summers smothered with smoke or losing their homes and communities to fire, that's kind of the driving force that we recognize that's driving forest management now across the West, is in a response to that fear and people not wanting to lose their homes and communities. And so this guide kind of cuts through all that and gets into kind of what are the core issues, how did we get here to this situation, and what can we actually do to address those fears and insecurities that people have that are very real to help make communities be safer and more resilient to fire so that we can coexist with fire and try and find a new equilibrium and balance between forests, fire, and communities in this context of a changing climate.
That is so necessary. So thank you for all your work on that. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, and we are going to try to go deep on this, but who put the guide together and where can people find it?
This guide was put together by members of the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance Wildfire Working Group. And so we'll talk a bit more about the Forest Climate Alliance later, I think, in the interview. But it's a regional network of more than 100 organizations working on forest defense and climate justice throughout the Pacific Northwest. You can find it at the Forest Climate Alliance website. So you can go to forestclimatealliance.org/wildfire-guide.
Or you can probably just go to forestclimatealliance.org, and I imagine that it's easy to find on the just by navigating from the homepage.
Yeah, and you can also find the guide on the Forest Climate Alliance's Instagram page. You can find it easily by searching. You can also go to Instagram, and our handle is at PNWFCAlliance.
Awesome. Now that we've got those plugs in, let's do a deep dive into the guide itself. So before we get into the key points, who's the intended audience for this guide, and what's your hope for how it gets used and how it gets out into the world?
Yeah, so this guide was really put together for folks in the conservation and forest advocacy space, as well as folks in the climate justice and climate action advocacy space. But a lot of the information here applies to anyone. There's a lot of information and tools and suggestions for how to have different conversations and how to talk about wildfire and forest and climate change in ways that, again, really center community safety and are responding to that underlying fear and anxiety that people have of losing their homes and communities. So it can be used by a lot of people in very different ways, but that's kind of the gist of it, is both giving people more context and information about how we got to this point, this moment of what feels like crisis with wildfires every summer, and then tools for having different kinds of conversations that can hopefully, like I said, open up a different future for coexistence and safety and resilience in this changing climate.
Great. So run me through the key points in the guide.
Yeah. So we're kind of starting in the guide with fire phobia. So the fear of fire. And, you know, most people today, like we've been talking about, have a fear of losing their homes and communities to fire. But the relationship of fear that our society has with fire goes back a lot further than that, right? To colonization, as European settlers arrived in Western North America and found that the indigenous communities that had been living here for so long were actively lighting fires every year as part of maintaining that ecological balance and vibrancy. And that really clashed with Western European ideas of what human nature relationship should look like, that fire is bad and we need to put it out, we need to engineer and control forests, but fire is not a force that we control is kind of, I think, the deeper cultural narrative there. So even though we've been trying to put out fires, just about every fire we can for more than 100 years, we know from research and from just the fact that indigenous communities have been putting fire on the land in a good way for so many thousands of years that these forests in our region, they need fire. Fire is part of the ecosystem. There are plants that only release their seeds when there's been a fire. There are plants that are specifically evolved and adapted to grow right after a fire. So our forests need fire, and it's a big part of how we've gotten to this loss of ecological equilibrium is we have these forests that need fire, and we've been trying to suppress and put out every fire because of that deeper cultural fear about fire. So the guide also talks about the false solutions being promoted by the timber industry. The idea that, you know, we just need to cut more trees. We have too many trees in the forest and we just need less trees. And that'll mean that we have less fire. And that makes sense on an intuitive level. You have a campfire, you want it to be bigger, you put more wood on it. But ecosystems are a lot more complex than that. And the way that fire behaves is a lot more complex than that. And a lot of these false solutions that the industry has been pushing would increase profits for them, but they won't actually keep communities safer. And that's really the focus of the guide more than anything, is how do we refocus the conversation on what has been proven to keep communities and homes and structures more resilient to catching fire and burning down. And that's really what we're with this guide. That's really the thrust of it, is how do we bring that back and center that in the conversation and shift this from an argument about what should or shouldn't be happening in the backcountry really far away from communities to what are the things that are going to keep communities safer and standing.
That is such an important point. And we've done a number of episodes focusing on that community safety, home hardening over backcountry interventions. But I mean, I think we can never talk about that too much, because whether you are an earth firster, whether you work in the timber industry, no matter who you are, like, nobody wants homes burning down, right? So focusing on the piece that we can all agree on, I think is so important. Sorry to belabor that point. And we can maybe come back to, or if you want to actually just run through a couple of the examples of what that looks like, feel free, and then we can keep going.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of alluded to it already, but I think the bigger shift here is, like I mentioned, moving where we think the problem is from out in the forest, distantly from communities, to where communities and homes and structures are. Because these are fire-adapted landscapes, and especially in the context of climate change, we're going to have fire in our forests. That is unavoidable. But what we do have control over is whether or not homes and communities burn down. So there's that defensible space around homes, clearing shaded fuel breaks, getting good fire back onto the land, especially the home hardening. And in some ways, it's small stuff that doesn't sound grandiose and sexy. It's putting smaller gapped vents on under eaves and clearing away burnable material from right around the edges of houses. In some ways, it's kind of boring stuff, but that is what has been proven again and again and again to keep communities safe. And that's what we really need to be focusing on. And that's one of the, I think, the challenges that we're trying to speak to with this guide, is the way that the community safety layer often gets conflated with the what's needed from an ecological resilience layer. And those are kind of two different things that need different solutions. But we do also talk about that in the guide, of how can we better support fire-adapted landscapes and the ecological resilience there. And then, yeah, the latter half of the guide is really diving deep into the messaging piece. So how do we tell effective stories? How do we craft narratives that meet people where they are and speak to kind of the affective space that they're in? And what are some examples of messages and ways that we can talk about these issues in ways that, like you said, will help bridge those gaps and kind of bridge that polarization? Because both within the conservation forest defense community and just throughout our region, logging, forest management, and fire has become such a polarizing issue that that's another thing that feels kind of broken. And so that's a big part of the guide, as well as how can we have different kinds of conversations that will connect with more people and that give people a sense of like, there's a way out of this. It doesn't have to be this way. We can coexist safely with fire.
So let's talk about that, the messaging part of the guide. What are some of the what are some of the mistakes that we make when we are trying to communicate this stuff? Because I think that that's really important for us to grapple with.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe the biggest mistake is focusing on facts and statistics and kind of leaving aside the whole, like, how people are feeling emotionally and the affective place that people are coming from, because that's what makes messages effective or not. That's what allows messages to land or not, is whether it speaks to the underlying those underlying feelings and emotions. And so leading with empathy and speaking to that real sense of crisis, fear, insecurity, and loss that people feel in relation to fire and smoke. As well, also, again, humans are storytelling creatures. We're not fact digesting creatures. And I think there's a tendency sometimes to focus on the nitty gritty details, the scientific facts and research and statistics, which are important for supporting stories. But when that is the core of the story that we're telling, we tend to lose people and it doesn't really connect with people. We also need to be telling stories that people see and recognize themselves in. And I think sometimes the ways that some folks talk about wildfire and forest management, it really only centers scientists. To the extent that there are any characters in those stories, it's mostly scientists and researchers, and everyday people don't hear or see themselves in those stories. I think those are some of the main things. I think also, you know, compelling stories, just like any kind of compelling story, compelling movies and novels, they have characters, clear characters, protagonists that we identify with, antagonists that we don't identify with, clear stakes and a clear path for resolution of the underlying conflict. And that's the kind of the stuff that we need to be using to craft more compelling messages, not just, you know, here are 10 facts and figures and statistics, because like you said, that doesn't connect with people and it doesn't shift how people think and feel about these issues. And that's a big part, I think, of the underlying thing here with more compelling and effective messages and stories. People see themselves in those stories, and it gives them like an emotional arc to resolution of the conflict that they already feel. Again, going back to this sense of like crisis and insecurity and fear that people are already living with.
Yeah, and we are really running through this guide, but I will say there is a lot more information in there. You have links to references, et cetera, et cetera. So again, where do folks find this guide if they're interested and want to dig deeper into this topic?
Yeah, the guide is available at the website for the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, and our website is forestclimatealliance.org. You can find it there. You can also find it on the Alliance's Instagram page. Again, the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance. And if you just search for that, you'll find our website and our Instagram page.
So I do want to talk about some of the critiques, not per se of the guide, but of how we are talking about fire, you know, the kind of conservation approach to wildfire and that home hardening over backcountry thinning. So first of all, what do you say to people who think this is just veneer for people opposing any kind of forest management, any kind of treatment?
Again, I think it's really important that we separate what might be needed ecologically in these ecosystems to help develop resilience and restore balance there from what is going to keep people's homes standing and keep people safe and communities safe. And that's really what we're trying to focus on with the guide. Like you said, there's a lot of disagreement even within the forest conservation community around how forests should be managed, what kinds of thinning or fuels reduction work, or what kinds of fire we should be focused on bringing back into our forests or not. There are intense debates about that. And we don't claim to have the answers. The Forest Climate Alliance itself is a very diverse network, and we have people on kind of all sides of that debate. And in some ways, again, what we're trying to do with the guide is similar to what we try and do with the Alliance of, like, we put our faith in the, like, if we get people together, even when we disagree, we can figure out solutions and ways to work together that make, you know, our lives and situations better. In the same way, the ways we talk about wildfire, let's focus on what's going to keep people safest, because as you said, that's something that everyone agrees on. And so I do want to, again, kind of emphasize the separation of when we're saying that forest thinning in the backcountry is not effective for keeping communities safe. That's not coming down on either side of the debate around how much thinning or logging should be happening anywhere far in the backcountry for ecological reasons. And I know there's some firefighters that feel like there needs to be some thinning in order to be able to safely put fire back on the landscape. And there are others who disagree. I think another layer of this that is often beneath the surface is a distrust of federal agencies that will look for and exploit any loophole in order to get more timber out of the forest to generate more revenue and money. Similarly, there's deeper problems there that we could, you know, spend more than an hour on with the way that, especially on public lands, a lot of these kinds of fuels reduction and thinning and resilience projects that are sold to the public as keeping communities safer, they're required to pay for themselves, which often means that there might be a really young, dense plantation of, you know, one species that they want to do some thinning and put some fire back on the land there. But in order to pay for that, they also need to include in the project logging of older, more mature and fire resilient forests. And so I think within these debates, there's some underlying issues that often like aren't explicitly part of the conversation, but are a big part of why people come from very different perspectives and hold such strong opinions, is some of these deeper layers that aren't spoken out loud, but are there in the room, whether or not we acknowledge them. But with this guide, again, we think that the focus really needs to be on community safety. And regardless of how you feel about what kinds of forest management should or shouldn't be happening in the backcountry, the reality is that right now, the anxiety and fear and insecurity that people feel about losing their homes and having their summers ruined by smoke, that is what is driving all forest management right now. And so if we can come forward with and support real solutions that do keep communities and homes safer and more resistant to igniting and burning down, and that there's more robust evacuation and response infrastructure, that there's more infrastructure for helping people deal with smoke, all those things will take the pressure off of the forest management decision and allow more space to have more of the nuanced science-based, how do we restore the ecological balance and maintain that in our forests separate without being driven and overwhelmed by the fear that people feel of losing their homes. And so in some ways, that's why we really, this needs to be the focus. And that's kind of counterintuitive sometimes for us to come to, you know, conservation groups and say, we need to talk less about trees. We need to talk more about how we're going to keep homes standing. But I think that's kind of the first order of business, is that until we can, you know, push forward some of these real solutions and implement them at a wide scale across the region, that fear that people feel is just going to overwhelm the more nuanced and complex conversations around forest management.
Yeah.
And that's what's been happening increasingly. So that's kind of, I understand that critique, and we're not trying to say, we're not coming down. We represent many members and they have diverse perspectives. But as we said, we can all agree that we want homes to stay standing and to not burn down. So we need to address that first.
Absolutely. We've like flipped the kind of, I guess you would say, hierarchy of needs here. And, you know, we're not working with an endless pot of resources, time, and money. So we need to focus on something that we all agree is the most important first, and then move outwards. So you mentioned smoke, and this is a key thing that I think we in the environmental conservation world are not addressing adequately, is smoke is the primary way that wildfire impacts average folks like myself, like you, anywhere. You know, my friends out in Bend, you know, where just like summer after summer, it's just smoke all summer long, right? Most people's homes don't actually burn, right? But basically all of us get affected by smoke to one degree or another every year. So, and that actually is something that the industry has really picked up that ball and run with it. So what would you say about that? Does the guide talk about how to talk about smoke and potential ideas around solutions to alleviate that pressure? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. That is the way that most people in the West most directly experience wildfire, is the smoke. And I think there's a few things to go on there. We do talk about it a bit in the guide, but there's definitely more work to be done around smoke. In some sense, it's inevitable. Like, we're not going to be able to avoid smoke. I guess I want to start with that. Like, either in the summer with these big fires that happen, or when we're doing prescribed burning and there's cultural burning happening, all those things generate smoke. Again, these are fire-adapted landscapes. There's going to be fire in our forests, and that's going to create smoke. And so how do we reframe the conversation from, you know, should we have smoke or not? How can we make it so that there is no smoke and we don't have to deal with that, too? How can we make it possible to coexist with the smoke? And that's like a public works kind of infrastructure problem. That's smoke shelters, air filters in buildings. What are the resources and tools that will help people deal with living in an environment that is smoky at least some of the time as a result of these fire adapted landscapes? But again, I think there's a deeper issue there as well of it's a cultural aversion. And part of this is because we just happened to have a cool wet period in the late 20th century climatically in the Western US that meant there was just less fire. And so we kind of have the wrong baseline for how much fire to expect in our forests and how much smoke to expect. And so that's kind of a deeper cultural change of expectations. But that doesn't have to mean, and we should not be talking about it as just deal with it. It's inevitable. Right. Don't worry about it.
Or ignoring it.
How can we make that? Right. Yeah. Yeah. What are the changes in infrastructures and solutions and policies that we need that would lessen or minimize the extent that we can, the impact that that has on people's daily lives, and not put that on everyone as individuals? Same with like home hardening and defensible space. If that's just put on everyone as individuals to figure out for themselves, what that means is that the people who have money and resources, the rich, are the only ones who are able to do that. And again, this whole thing is a problem that's been created by public policy over the last 150 years. And so it's going to take public policy to address it meaningfully. So there should be funding from the public funding to put smoke filters and to create smoke shelters so that when there are these big fires and these really intensely smoky days, there are safe places for people to go that are going to have clean air. And then beyond that, even not just how do we create a few, you know, one or two spots in each community, how do we then push that infrastructure out to where people live and yeah. supporting you know, smoke filtration and clean air within homes and communities, and not put that on individuals to, you know, figure out for themselves.
Right. Yeah. I think it is important that we are putting forward solutions to that, because if we just cede that ground to the industry, you know, they're partnering with public health officials, like they're definitely getting traction on that. So definitely something we need to have really forthright answers for. So is there anything that we've missed on the guide that you really want to get included?
I think one thing that I want to say that we haven't touched on so far is that, again, just with trying to shift the conversation from wildfire and smoke being a forest or vegetation or fire management and control problem across tens of millions of acres, we need to shift the conversation to how do we keep homes and communities safer. And for folks who want to be conserving and protecting forests, it's hard and counterintuitive to focus on talking about homes and communities instead of talking about forests. But for most people, the way these arguments boil down, who are not deeply enmeshed in it, is that we've got the timber industry and some politicians saying effectively more logging or active forest management will prevent destructive fires. And for most people, that boils down to do something. And folks who are concerned about the timber industry, you know, further degrading and destroying ecosystems as a result of this, often saying more logging is environmentally destructive and it won't keep communities safer from fire. For most people, that message boils down to don't do something. And as long as this is debate about do something or don't do something, which is how it comes down and filters out to most people, as long as the debate about fire is about what's happening in the forest, we're going to keep losing most of the public in that conversation. And so that's, again, the real thrust of why we need to try and shift the conversation to focus on what's going to keep communities safe, so that our message doesn't boil down to people as don't do anything, which is how it often comes out.
That is such an important way to underscore that point. So, final words to you as we wrap up. Is there anything we've missed? Anything you want to get included? Final plugs. The floor is yours.
I guess maybe I just want to end with giving an example of kind of how we can put this messaging guide into action and what that can look like to, again, give people a taste of it. So come and check it out after you hear this on our website, forestclimatealliance.org. just comparing two messages and how they might land and how we can tell a different story. So message A, historically, we used to actually have a lot more fire in our forest than we do today. And more fire is good for forests after 100 years of fire suppression. People shouldn't build homes in the wildland-urban interface without accepting the risk of fire, and more logging is ecologically damaging. That's one message. It's a common message historically coming from conservation groups. And nothing in that message is necessarily wrong. But compare how that might land to the average person living in a rural community or, you know, next to a forest in the wildland urban interface with this other message. We all deserve to live in peace and safety and not spend every summer fearing that we'll lose everything. Protecting homes and communities should be our top priority, not creating more profits for the timber industry by spending money on logging instead of on protecting homes.
Right.
And I just want to offer that as a taste. Yeah, very different. And, you know, I personally don't disagree with anything in either of those messages, but I know one is going to land with a lot more people and shift the focus again to what's most important and most compelling to most people of keeping homes and communities safe, that every dollar spent on a logging project somewhere is a dollar that's not being spent putting, you know, new vents on homes and, you know, making them more ignition resistant so they don't catch fire in the first place. Because that's, especially in this age of climate change, that's the thing that we have the most control over.
That is a great place to leave it. I could keep talking to you about this for hours, and I'm sure we will. But for now, Alex Budd, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining me on Coast Range Radio.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's been great.
That's all the time we have for today on Coast Range Radio. We are an independent, volunteer-run show. You can find Coast Range Radio free and ad-free on all podcast apps. You can follow us on Instagram. And the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. I would love to hear what you think of the show, whether you loved it, hated it, anything, any of the above, whether you got a sourdough recipe, just give us a shout sometime at coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. I want to be a cowboy.